Chapter 40. The Air Canada jet bumped through a thick cloud whose soft white curve showed the first orange tint from the setting sun. As the plane began its slow descent towards Guadalupe, Summer gazed through her window and watched the deep, dark blue-purple water below turn to light blue and then turquoise as the aircraft flew over the reefs and lagoons. Sitting next to her in the aisle seat, Dirk studied a chart of the waters around the Îles des Saintes, a group of islands to the south of Guadalupe. She stared with growing curiosity as the two main islands of Basse-Terre and Grande-Terre merged together in the shape of a butterfly. Basse-Terre formed the western wing and was blanketed with thickly forested hills and mountains. Surrounded by lush ferns, its rainforest contained some of the Caribbean's highest waterfalls, which flow down from the island's loftiest peak, La Soufrière, a smoldering volcano that rises above 4,800 feet. Both islands, with a total land area the size of Luxembourg, were separated by a narrow channel filled with mangroves called the Rivière Salée. The eastern wing of the butterfly, Grande-Terre, was a contrast to Basse-Terre. The island is mostly dominated by flat terrain and rolling hills, much of which is cultivated in sugarcane, the major source for the three distilleries that produce Guadalupe's fine rums. Summer's heart rose in anticipation of enjoying some of the island's many black-and-white sand beaches that were romantically edged with swaying palms. Deep down, she knew it was probably wishful thinking. Once she and Dirk had finished their survey for Odysseus's lost fleet, Admiral Sandecker would no doubt order them home without allowing a few days of rest and enjoyment. She made up her mind to stay, regardless of the consequences of incurring the Admiral's wrath. The plane made a wide circle that took it over Pointe-à-Pitre, the commercial capital of Guadalupe. She looked down at the red tile roofs mingled with those of corrugated metal. The pleasant town was embellished by a picturesque square in its center, surrounded by outdoor shops and cafes. The narrow streets seemed busy and lively, with people heading home for dinner. Few drove cars. Many of them walked, while most rode motorcycles and motor scooters. Lights were already beginning to flicker on in the little houses around the port city. Ships were tied to docks, with little fishing boats coming into harbor after a day's catch. The pilot settled the plane on the landing approach to Guadalupe Polcarib Airport. The landing gear thumped as the wheels dropped and locked, and the wing flaps hummed into a downward position. For a brief instant, the last of the setting sun flashed into the windows before the plane settled onto the runway with the usual bounce, protest of tires and the shrill whine of the reverse thrust of the turbines as the plane braked before taxiing to the terminal. Summer always loved early evenings in the tropics. The offshore breezes usually came up and blew away the worst of the day's heat and humidity. She loved the smell of wet vegetation after a rain and the aroma of the ever-present tropical flowers. "How's your French?" Dirk asked Summer as they descended the boarding stairs from their aircraft at the Guadalupe airport. "About as good as your Swahili," she said, looking radiant in a vibrant flowered skirt and matching blouse. "Why do you ask?" "Only the tourists speak English. The locals speak French or a French Creole dialect. Since neither of us majored in languages in school, we'll just have to use sign language." Dirk gave his sister a long look and then laughed. He handed her a small book. "Here's an English-French dictionary. I'll lean on you for any translations." They walked into the terminal and followed the first passengers off the plane to health and immigration. The immigration agent looked up at them before he stamped their passports. "In Guadalupe for business or pleasure?" he asked in fluent English. Summer wrinkled her pert nose at Dirk. "Pleasure," she replied, flashing what appeared to be a large diamond ring on her left hand. "We're on our honeymoon." The agent coolly eyed her breasts, nodded, and smiled approvingly as he pounded the stamp on blank passport pages. "Enjoy your stay." He said it in a tone that bordered on the unvirtuous. As soon as they were out of earshot, Dirk asked, "What is this stuff about our being on a honeymoon? And where did you get that ring?" "I thought acting as newlyweds was a good cover," she answered. "The ring is glass. Cost me all of $8. I hope no one takes a close look at it or they'll think I'm the cheapest husband in the world." They walked into the luggage area where they had to wait 20 minutes for their bags to arrive. After loading them onto a cart, they cleared customs and moved into the lobby of the terminal. A small crowd of 30 or so people stood waiting to greet friends and relatives. One little man in a white suit with the medium dark skin of a Creole held a little sign that read, Pitt. "That's us," said Dirk. "This is Summer, and I'm Dirk Pitt. Charles Moreau." The little man held out his hand. His eyes were as black as ink, and he had a nose that looked sharp enough to fight a duel. He came up to Summer's shoulders in a body that was as slim as a sapling. "Your flight was only 10 minutes late. That has to be some kind of record." Then he bowed, took Summer's hand, and brushed his lips over her knuckles in true continental fashion. "Admiral Sandecker said you were a handsome couple. I assume he also told you we are brother and sister." "He did? Is there a problem?" Dirk glanced at Summer, who smiled in mock innocence. "Just wanted to be clear on that point." Summer and Moreau moved through the exit doors while Dirk followed with the baggage cart. An attractive, raven-haired woman, wearing the traditional Creole dress, a full, vividly colored skirt in a madras plaid of orange and yellow, matching headdress and a white lace blouse with petticoat and scarf draped over one shoulder, walked squarely into Dirk from the side. Wise in the ways of travel, he immediately patted the pocket that held his wallet, but it was still in place. She stood there, massaging her shoulder. "I'm so sorry. It was my fault." "Are you hurt?" Dirk asked solicitously. "Now I know what it feels like to run into a tree." Then she looked up at him and smiled openly. "I'm Simon Reze. Perhaps I'll see you around town." "Perhaps," Pitt replied, without offering his name. The woman nodded at Summer. "You have a handsome and charming man." "It can be on occasion," Summer said with a trace of sarcasm. The woman then turned and walked into the terminal. "What do you make of that?" said Pitt, bemused. "You can't say she wasn't brazen," muttered Summer. "Most strange," said Moreau. "She gives the impression she lives here. I was born on this island, and I've never laid eyes on her before." Summer looked vaguely concerned. "If you ask me, the collision was pre-planned." "I agree," said Dirk. "She was after something. I don't know what. But our encounter didn't look accidental." Moreau led them across the street to the parking lot and stopped at a BMW 525 sedan. He pushed the security lock on his keyring and opened the trunk. Dirk deposited the luggage and they settled into the seats. Moreau pulled out onto the road leading to Pointe-à-Pitre. "I've reserved a small suite with 2 rooms for you at the Canela Beach Hotel, one of our most popular hotels, and one where a young couple on a budget might stay. Admiral Sandecker's instructions stated that you were to keep a low profile during your search for treasure." "Historical treasure," Summer corrected him. "He's right," said Dirk. "If word leaked that Numa was on a treasure hunt, we'd be mobbed." "And thrown off the islands," added Moreau. "Our government has strict laws protecting our underwater heritage." "If we're successful," said Summer, "your people will inherit an epic-making discovery." "All the more reason to keep your expedition secret."
"Are you an old friend of the Admiral?"
"I met James many years ago when I was the Guadalupe consul in New York. Since I've retired, he hires me on occasion for Numa business in and around this part of the Caribbean." Moreau drove through the lush green hills down to the harbor and around the city along the southern shore of Grande Terre until he reached the outskirts of the town of Gossier. Then he took a small dirt road that wound around back to the main thoroughfare. Summer gazed through her window and admired the houses that sat amid lush, beautifully maintained gardens. "Giving us a tour of the country?"
"A taxi cab has been hanging on us rather closely since we left the airport," said Moreau.
"I wanted to see if he was following us."
Dirk turned in his seat and peered through the rear window.
"The green Ford?"
"The same."
Moreau left the residential section and skirted around a steady stream of buses, tourists on motor scooters, and the city's fleet of taxis. The driver of the green Ford taxi struggled to keep up, but was hindered by the slow-moving traffic. Moreau expertly threaded his way around 2 buses that blocked both sides of the road. He made a sharp right turn onto a narrow street that ran between rows of homes whose quaint architectural style was French colonial. He made another left-hand turn and then another at the next block until he was on the main road again. The taxi swung over a path beside the road around the buses, gained the lost distance, and stuck to Moreau's rear bumper like glue. "He's interested in us, all right," said Dirk. "Let us see if I can lose him," said Moreau. He waited until there was a break in the traffic. Then, instead of turning, he shot straight ahead and darted through the traffic onto the street across the main road. The taxi driver was impeded by the stream of motor scooters, cars, and buses a good 30 seconds before he could break through and take up the chase. Turning a corner and temporarily losing sight of the taxi, Moreau swung into the driveway of a house and parked behind a large oleander bush. A few moments later, the green taxi swept past the driveway at high speed and was soon lost in a dust cloud. They remained waiting for a few minutes before Moreau backed out of the driveway and joined the traffic rush again on the main road. "We've lost him, but I'm afraid it may be only temporary." "Having missed us," mused Dirk, "he may pull the same trick and wait for us." "I doubt it," said Summer confidently. "My money says he's still on a wild goose chase." "You lose." Dirk laughed, pointing through the windshield toward the green Ford that was parked along the side of the road, its driver talking excitedly over a cell phone. "Pull over next to him, Charles." Coming up behind the taxi slowly, Moreau suddenly pulled around and stopped inches away. Dirk leaned out the window and knocked on the door of the taxi. "Are you looking for us?" The startled driver took one look at Dirk's grinning face, dropped the cell phone, jammed his foot on the accelerator, and tore off down the palm-lined road toward the town of Saint Anne, his wheels spinning in the gravel of the shoulder until they struck the asphalt and shrieked in protest. Moreau pulled the car over and stopped, watching the taxi disappear in the traffic ahead. "The lady at the airport. And now this," Moreau said quietly. "Who can be interested in a pair of representatives from Numa on a diving expedition?" "The word treasure is a powerful aphrodisiac and spreads like an epidemic," said Summer. "Somehow word of our intent arrived ahead of us." Dirk stared thoughtfully into the distance at the point in the road where the taxi had vanished. "We'll know for certain tomorrow who's following in our wake when we sail over to Branwen Island." "Are you familiar with Branwen Island?" Summer asked Moreau.
"Enough to know that it's dangerous to go near it," Moreau said quietly. "It used to be called Île de Rouge, French for red, because of its reddish volcanic soil. The new owner renamed it. I'm told Branwen was a Celtic goddess known as the Venus of the Northern Seas and the deity of love and beauty. Conversely, among the more superstitious natives, it lives up to its reputation as the Island of Death." Dirk was enjoying the warm, scented breeze through his open window. "Because of treacherous reefs or heavy surf?"
"No," answered Moreau, breaking so two children in colorful dresses could cross the road.
"The person who owns the island does not like trespassers."
"According to our computer department's data search," said Summer, "the owner is a woman by the name of Ipona Eliad."
"A very mysterious lady. As far as we know, she has never set foot on Basse-Terre or Grande-Terre."
Summer brushed her hair that was becoming stringy from the dampness. "Ms. Eliad must have caretakers if she maintains an elegant home on Branwen Island. Satellite photos show an airfield, a few buildings, and an odd circle of tall columns and an elegant house," said Moreau. "It's claimed that fishermen or tourists who tried to land on the island were later found dead. They usually washed up at a beach on Basse-Terre many miles away." "What about police investigations?"
Moreau slowly shook his head as he switched on his headlights in the growing dusk.
"They found no evidence of foul play and could never prove the victims had actually set foot on the island."
"Couldn't local forensic experts determine how the victims died?" Moreau gave a quick laugh.
"The bodies were usually examined by a local doctor, or even a dentist who happened to be available when and where they came ashore.
Due to decomposition, any results were speculation. Most all were written off as drownings. Then he added, and yet, rumors circulated that the victims' hearts had been cut out.
Sounds morbid, muttered Summer.
More like distorted rumors, said Dirk.
All the more reason to stay a safe distance offshore.
Not possible if we intend to do a sub-bottom survey of the harbor.
Just keep a sharp eye out, said Moreau. I'll give you my cell phone number. If you spot trouble, call me immediately. I'll have a police patrol boat on its way within 10 minutes.
Moreau continued down the road for another 2 miles before turning into the driveway leading to the hotel and stopped at the entrance. A porter hurried out and opened the car door for Summer. Dirk came around to the rear of the car and opened the trunk so the porter could take their luggage and bags of dive gear into the hotel and up to their suite.
You're within walking distance of a variety of restaurants, shops, and entertainment clubs, said Moreau. I'll pick you up at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning and take you to the dock, where I've chartered a boat for your search. The sub-bottom profiler, underwater metal detector, and jet probe that Commander Rudy Gunn air-freighted from Florida is on board and ready for operation. I also had a small compressor mounted on the deck to run your excavation dredge and jet probe.
You were very thorough, Dirk complimented him.
We're grateful for your help and courtesy, said Summer, as he gallantly kissed her hand.
And thank you for the interesting ride from the airport, added Dirk, shaking Moreau's hand.
Not entirely of my doing, Moreau said with a little smile. Then his face clouded.
Please be cautious. There is something going on here that is beyond our grasp. I don't want you to end up like the others.
Dirk and Summer stood in the entrance to the hotel lobby and watched Moreau drive through the front gate.
What do you think of all this? Asked Summer.
I don't have the vaguest idea, Dirk said slowly. But I'd give my right arm if Dad and Al were here.